Did we lose Brad? Where'd Brad go? Oh, there is Brad Frost. You take your microphone off.
He was learning new technologies.
All right, and we also are going to open it up for audience questions here in a couple minutes. I'm just going to kick it off with a few questions. Brad, I was a little curious with the patterns and things like that. If there are times that you find the patterns are constraining from a design perspective, do you ever find yourself thinking that you just want to set them aside for a bit and do something else? Or are there problems that you find where you can't build from the patterns up?
Yeah, it's a great question and something that I think a lot of visual designers react to, and I'm sure you guys can attest to this as well. Visual designers are like, don't handcuff me, man. Like, I need to be creative, you know? Like, it's, you know, you're shackling my creativity
by
shoving these. Yes, in a way. One of the sort of counter arguments I always say is it's like, aren't you taught in design school that, like, consistency and cohesion are sort of a good thing, that, like, you know, every page of an experience shouldn't be bespoke? That being said, it's about sort of when and where you establish patterns. A lot of people, I think, have this misconception that it's like you start designing the buttons and then you start designing the what I call like molecules or like sort of components, and then eventually you put them together and cross your fingers that they all come together as like a consistent, like a cohesive whole. So it's about sort of, whenever you're designing things and playing around, it's like you want that freedom. Like, you don't want to be shackled, but once you land on a design you're happy with, that's whenever you go, okay, you know, like, one, you should have it in the back of your mind. You should be like, how could I reuse these things? You know, you should be thinking in terms of reuse and components and stuff like that, but don't limit yourself, don't sort of handcuff yourself. But once you land on that design, then it's time to go, okay, let's establish those patterns that we just created in a pattern library and look to reuse those elsewhere. And whenever you go through your process and you find limitations of a specific patterns, then you have a conversation and say, okay, this thing is you know, a little too constrained or whatever, we need it to do this as well, and then maybe that's a time to introduce yet another pattern. So you're doing it in sort of a thoughtful, deliberate way, in an additive way, rather than sort of like establishing rules and restrictions up front and then limiting the whole process.
Gotcha. And that actually brings up something that I wanted to ask Sophie about. Sophie, you had written and talked a little bit, I think, or maybe it was on the podcast that you did with Ethan and Karen. In one of those situations, you talked a bit about Yushahidi trying to establish relationships between the pattern library and the product and trying to, you know, as the product evolved, or as the pattern library evolved, trying to make sure that those changes were reflected back into the product. And I was curious how that's working and what, you know, what sort of challenges you're seeing in that space.
So we had kind of, I would say, as a whole with this product development, three large deliverables. The first, we've been calling it a design framework, but it's basically could be a prototype, however you define it, which is just all of our features and how they're going to work. We did that just as wireframes and really defining everything. And then we have the pattern library, which is all of the visual design and front-end code, so that's a deliverable. And then we have the platform itself. So the first one, which was all of the UX, that had to be done first before anything else was started. And that was a mostly design effort, but it was a collaborative effort with the engineering team, so we were all on the same page with that. And then at that point, all of our dev team could be working, building the platform while we were doing the pattern library. And we were working on parallel tracks, basically. And then at some point, once the pattern library was close enough along, and the pattern library defined like layouts and stuff, so we weren't very bound, but then we met in the middle, and then we're still continuing, even though we're about to launch, we're on separate tracks. Anything in design gets done in the pattern library. Any views and layouts are treated as a pattern, so that's just a very involved pattern. And then that all gets translated over into the product itself.
Nice. So we're going to start taking questions in a moment, and there are going to be a couple of Cloud4 people running around with microphones, because I suspect it might be a little hard to get out of the theater seats. So if you have a question, you know, raise your hand, and we'll get a microphone for you. Val, I don't know if it's my like inexperience with animation or my lack of imagination. I don't know. But I, the thing that I'm still hung up on and have trouble sort of sorting out is, do you find that that there are multiple states in the animation across like that continuum from whatever the widest point is that you're going to? Or in some of the examples, it looked like there was just two. Do those have any relationship to what's going on from sort of a layout breakpoint perspective? Like, I'm just a little, like, you know, you on the other side of having done this a bit, how are you seeing that sort of map out?
It looks like it's pretty, like, for me, and it seems like that for some of these other sites I've looked at too, it's really similar to the whole way you go through the visual design, the layout, where you're like, okay, changing the size, stuff looks broken, guess I should change some things, and just kind of go from there. And also thinking about it a little bit ahead of time, or maybe adjusting as you go, to make it so, like, you can maybe not make 100 different changes and only make a few. You know, I think we've all been in that position where we're like, oh, I'm just going to change the type size in this headline every 100 pixels. Oh, gosh, that maybe isn't a good idea. So you totally go down that same path, right? You're like, oh, I could just adjust that movement a little bit here and then a little bit here. But if you made maybe, you know, some higher level changes or just change the behavior a little bit more on a global level, you can then do like two or three breakpoints.
Do you think, so from a layout perspective, a lot of stuff, we find a lot of utility in starting from small screen design and working our way up. In some ways, it feels like when I look at this animation that the true expression of that animation is oftentimes the widescreen version of it. Is it the opposite direction on the animations that you've seen or that you've worked on, or does it still make sense to sort of start from the small screens and work up?
I think it does, whichever one you're most comfortable with. I mean, I tend to go big to small on that just because I find it easier to like kind of take things out and focus in on what's most important. And then but you know, going the other way of kind of adding in to support whatever's most important works too. I guess whichever one feels best to you, and just looking at the overall spectrum in the end.
So Jeremy's "it depends" statement.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, can I re-answer that question?
Yeah. Go ahead.
It depends.
Excellent. Do we have audience questions here? Any hands raised? I cannot see a thing up here.
I have
so.
A question for Val.
Oh. Yes, please.
I'm curious because this is something.
Push to talk. Hey, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There we go. I think my question is primarily for Brad, but maybe for Val as well. I didn't hear much today about server-side responsive frameworks, and I wondered how that maybe changes your approach towards designing, especially from an atomic perspective, as you consider what device detection might look like in terms of what you send to the browser, and maybe somewhat from Val as well, as you consider the performance of your animation. Do you maybe plan for server-side device detection as you plan those animation, maybe to improve performance, or is that really a consideration?
Okay, so the question is about how does server-side device detection sort of give us an extra layer of, like, an extra tool to sort of work with to create?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, thinking about things from, so you use the word component a lot. I love that word, right? So
yes.
Thinking about a component and how it interacts with the space, with the user on its own, how does that change your planning as you're planning out the way these components interact with each other or the full space as a platform? What does that look like if you are planning for a server-side framework in addition to your, obviously you're always going to be using your client-side frameworks, your you know, CSS to control layout and response, but what about from a server side?
Sure. So the way that I sort of work, so I help build a tool called Pattern Lab that allows us to establish sort of the front end agnostic of any server side sort of thing. So it's like you could drop it into like a WordPress site, a Drupal site, some Node framework, some Rails, what, it doesn't really matter. And I actually think that a lot of people conflate the front end and the back end maybe a little too much. I think that we're starting to see a trend towards sort of more decoupled things where the CMS is just sort of, you know, giving you the content, the raw content, without making a whole lot of assumptions about how that's going to represent on the front end. And I think that that's a healthy trend. That being said, and I think Sophie did a great job talking about like personalization and localization and like all of that stuff, like, yeah, that logic and stuff should live on the server and should very much, I think, influence, you know, how the front end patterns get, you know, applied and stuff. So for example, like your world example is a great, of Facebook, you know, sort of changing things, or, you know, you're logged in or you're a lifelong user versus a first time user. It's like there's, you know, a lot of different factors that, you know, you're not gonna do all of that logic on the front end. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity for the server to provide extra layers of personalization and modification that will make its way onto the front end. And from a workflow perspective, I think it's just absolutely, you're just saying about how your platform and your sort of pattern library track are running parallel. And I think it's about collaborating and communicating to make sure that the front end you're creating jives with what's being produced on like from the platform standpoint and vice versa, so that you don't hand off something that's totally unrealistic or unfeasible.
So Val, for you, are you finding like device detection as a part of how you make decisions about animation at all?
Hasn't really come up for anything I've worked on, but I mean, the same situations, like similar to what Sophie was showing, what Brad was just saying, like if you wanted to personalize things based on how long the user's been using things, where they are, I could totally see why you might want to show different animations for that. But it would kind of be the same idea of like the server side tells you which one of those categories you're in, and I would still think the animation would be handled on the front end.
So it sounds like mostly you're using server side stuff for personalization and other things, but not necessarily device detection.
Yeah.
I don't know about Yoshihide. Are they using device detection for anything?
I'm not sure. For front end stuff, I'm just doing all front end patterns, and then the platform is going to decide which one to serve up. But we're just
The best way I've heard like sort of server-side device detection described is as a scalpel. It's sort of like a last resort where it's like if it's just totally impossible to convert something on the front end, or like let's just say you have just some like giant widget that was built in 1998 and you're not going to convert that into a response. It's like the server-side device detection becomes a bit of a scalpel where it's like you could rip that out and replace it with something else, but you don't want to. You don't want to lean on that. You use that as an exception rather than a rule.
Okay. Do we have other audience questions? One down here.
Is this on?
All right.
So my question's for Val, actually. You talked a lot about you building your animations for the context that you're working within, and you showed some great examples for animation for UI and UX versus for emphasis. Mm-hmm. How do you handle building animation for UI and UX and building in a way to translate it for accessibility and non-visual interpretation? To make the same kind of emphasis, think like the menu coming down. How do you build that in a way that translates?
Mostly through being, I guess, redundancy, or through redundancy of, you know, something is really important and it's like, I don't know, menu coming down, or like a button that shakes because it's super important, or like form field shaking because you made a mistake or there's an error. Of making sure that important information is being conveyed in more ways than just motion, like through like color, through actual text as well, which will help make it even more emphasized for anyone who can get like all three of those, read it, see it, and see the color change. But anyone who might be missing one of those can still see that something's happened and that it should be, you know, something they want to pay attention to. So kind of layering that in and covering all your bases, basically.
Great. Sophie, you had a question. Well, let Sophie ask her question of Val, and then we'll go back to the audience.
I was curious about kind of combining all of these and how you put animations into a style guide or a pattern library, and defining reusable animations. You know, less so for like a hero image that pops out, but how do you start defining things and knowing when to use those in a system?
Yeah, definitely. I like that question. I'm trying to think of a short answer. if you're using motion, especially as part of your actual interaction, supporting your UX, you want to have that in your components and everything and things in your style guide. There's kind of two approaches you can take. One is kind of like a top-down of like, this is our design philosophy. IBM style guy is an example of that, where like we emulate machines in motion, therefore our drawers move in the same way as us. The tape drives did when computers had tape drives. And then there's, you know, that's one way to kind of push it down to like, here's what our motion should look like, and then apply that to things that move. Another way to do it is to kind of pick the things you will animate. Be like, we will use animation to direct attention. We will use animation for things entering and exiting the screen or different contexts. And that's it. You know, those are the two things we use. And you can kind of even break that down into smaller pieces, like here's what an entrance would look like. Here's what
like type of easing we're going to use.
The easing we'll use, the timing we'll use. And then maybe like here's a really big thing entering and how we change that. So those are kind of the two approaches that seem to work really well.
I noticed, I think it was the Salesforce pattern library has a ton of animations inside of it. I think Rachel Neighbors worked on that as an example that might be something to look at.
Yeah, and they have, I mean, for them, a lot of what that's directed at is people who are building applications for Salesforce. So they have a lot of very specific, like, here's a fade animation, here's a roll animation. So you can see that people are trying to take those pieces and build up something else. And then you contrast that with IBM, where they're like, this is how a drawer menu pulls out. This is how a list animates in. And theirs are a little bit more complex because they're looking at people building IBM products. And for them, the design factor or that design philosophy is more what's coming in. For Salesforce, it's more like, let's use a common set of building blocks. So it's really interesting to see those two kind of different approaches to come to the same thing.
Interesting, interesting. For another question, audience, it looks like there's one back there.
By the way, we can't see any of you.
Yeah.
I hope you're still here.
I think this question is for Sophie. This has to do with the quote about if it works in Africa, it'll work anywhere. So how can designers and developers that aren't in Africa know if it works there?
That's a good question. Send it to your coworker who lives there. No, that's what I do. That is a good question. I just make sure always to test. I have an iPhone and I'm so used to using it. Testing on other devices, even if you don't have one, I use Browser Stack all the time just to get an approximation of how it'll look on an older phone I keep all my old iPhones, so make sure that they're working on those. Use web page test, and you can change where you are and change your connection speed so that see how it's loading there. I would just test as much as possible. And then also from a design, like not only testing, but just always be thinking about what is the, like if someone is seeing this page and they can only do one thing, what is the most important thing that I give them and make sure to be designing around that.
Or plan your next trip, like put that in your budget.
Yeah. Our company did that. They like did a African road trip I didn't go, unfortunately, with the whole purpose of testing products.
Facebook did something similar, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. They all sort of went over and basically are like, our stuff doesn't work at all. And it's, it gives a much needed perspective. But I know I've definitely seen a lot of companies will sort of force their teams to go Android or buy a grocery store or smartphone or whatever for a while. Jason, you had the great advice of just going into a Verizon store and just like, you know, doing your testing there and stuff. But then you also, it was brilliant actually. Cheap, easy, whatever. Yeah.
It works.
Yeah, yeah. But then also, you know, the community device labs and stuff, which you guys all help pioneer and stuff. I think that's fantastic. And then a while ago, I had this idea of like browser roulette. So it's like every time you refresh the page as you're designing or developing, you get random scenarios. So it's like you're on like 3G and a viewport of this much and touch is disabled or whatever. And like that would be, right? So it'd be like browser stack like mushed together and randomized. So we should be, but just even if the tools aren't there to do that, it has everything to do with like our mentality of like designing. Don't assume you're on a good connection by default.
Do we have other audience questions? Okay, over here.
Hello.
Hi. This question is for Sophie. You said global design cannot rely on personas, and then you jumped into the conversation of language. was language or taxonomy or information architecture the only tactic that you used to develop your product, or were there other research methods like use cases or
so other
tactics?
So we definitely do have use, I mean, we there are lots of use cases. I think when I said that, it was just trying to say that it's difficult, like there isn't one that's more important than another. In our case, they're all equally very important. So we couldn't design just for a crisis in a certain country. It needs to work just as well across the board. I would say language has been the biggest challenge, but also I think it's a good thing to start with because it is the very, very basics. So if you can get just that right, it's easier to build on. If you get that wrong, anything you put on top of it is not going to make any sense. So I would say language was definitely the most important part. And again, just starting, making sure that things are very basic and not distracting. So same thing with our design, with our pattern library. It's very bare bones. It's not extremely designed and flashy. But now that we have that, people can take our pattern library and build themes and easily add onto it. We can build themes. So just by making sure that we get the basics right, it's a lot easier to add on.
I think we have time for a couple more questions, and then we'll take a break. Looks like there's a phone, couple of phones
couple
waving.
Phones.
Oh,
it's
smart.
Like the lighter
like I'm at a
concert.
That is
yeah.
That is brilliant. I still can't see you, but I can see your phone.
I just
phone.
See a floating phone.
Do we see the phone over there?
That's
looking
awesome.
For a microphone? Oh, the phone went off. Oh, you're lost forever.
I hope they're okay.
Hello?
All right. Do you have a mic? Oh, there's one in front. I'm so sorry. We'll get you next. Sorry.
Thank you. Pattern libraries are great, and I love starting from the basics, but how do you show the client the advantage of starting with the basics? They want to see the theme and a final beautiful mock-up. So I'm kind of interested in your thoughts on how to communicate the value of pattern libraries to clients.
I can start.
Yeah, go for it.
I worked for a client company before this job, and this has definitely been one of the benefits of this job is that we can jump into patterns right away without having to sell it to a client. We tend to sell a little bit internally. I think pattern library is always something you can be doing behind the scenes. So while you're designing mock-ups, you can be slowly starting to take an inventory of what's making up those mock-ups and get a head start on it. But I agree that it's a challenge.
If you go into it going, we're going to design you buttons and show you buttons, the client's going to go, you're fired, right? Like, but for me, and you know, sort of what atomic design for me has been is like it allows you to paint the whole as well as the parts of the whole, right? They're not two separate things. It's one and the same, right? Like the page level, the final thing that your clients are going to sign off on and that your users are going to use are comprised of these smaller components. So it's not an either or. It's not something to sell them on. Like in order to make the whole, you need to make the parts of that whole. And by sort of practicing, you know, as I've been working with like atomic design the last couple of years and exposing that to the clients, I basically am like, hey, do you like saving time and money? Yes or no? And then it's like, and they're like, let me think about this. And then it's like, okay, well, by establishing these patterns, it allows us to, you know, the first couple pages, the first like sort of primary screens are going to be tough to design, and that's going to do that. But once we have our Lego bricks, once we have these puzzle pieces, the rest of the project's going to go a lot smoother, and we're going to end up with this nice, consistent, cohesive experience that we can build off of for years to come. So in my experience, it hasn't really been hard to sell them on it. It's just sort of about helping them understand, like, hey, this is just how things are done. We're not actually here to sell you on anything. We're just going to do it. The same way that we talk about like accessibility and performance and all that other stuff anymore. It's like, these aren't even points of conversation. We're just going to do it whether you like it or not, because that's what good design and development is.
All right. Do we have a question? Yes.
Get the phone person.
Yes. Am I just a disembodied voice right now for you guys?
You totally. Is that God?
I could shine a flashlight on my face like a scary story, but... Yeah, there we go. Hi.
So this question is mostly for Sophie, since you talked about it, but Brad and Val, if you have input on it, that would be cool too. We do some work on pattern library related stuff at our company as well, and we've often tend to work on separate design and development tracks with that. And what we found to be one of the biggest challenges is translating, or I should say, handing the handoff process from the design to the dev track, right? I'm curious what your experience has been in maybe finding solutions to make that process easier, or if you have some secret sauce that makes that not so painful. But yeah, that's just one of the bigger challenges we face, so I'm curious what you've done to deal with it.
I think one of the things is we're using the same front-end code base, so they're using all of our CSS, so that avoids a lot of implementation issues where things are not quite right. So that's one part. The most challenges I have are explaining how things should interact with each other. So, you know, we have all of these layouts, but it's not immediately clear that if you click this button, this should happen, and then you get pushed off to this layout, and, you know. So we do a lot of just building examples, and it doesn't take too long since we have all of the stuff in the front end already. We just link pages together, and those are separate from the pattern library. They're using the same code as the pattern library, but they're more just prototypes. So you can click around most of the site, especially the more complex pieces, to understand how things are working. It's not hooked up to any database or anything, but it gives everyone an idea of how things are supposed to work. And then we just have a whole lot of Google Docs explaining stuff.
To follow up then, are your designers mostly people who are comfortable working in code rather than static mockups, or?
Yeah.
There it is. There we go, getting to the meat of it.
But I will say, if you have a good team that is, we're different levels. Like some, you know, I'm probably more design than code, but I do a lot of code, right. And then part of our design, our front-end developer is part of the design team, but he doesn't really touch any design. He does front-end, and then we have a third person who is design, front-end, and he's also super crazy JavaScript whiz. So then, like, the three of us put our rings together.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yep. And that's just it. And that's sort of coming back to like this notion of the T-shaped skill set. Mm-hmm. It's like designers don't need to know how to code, but they absolutely need to be aware of it and know what's possible with web layout, know what's possible with animation, mm-hmm. know what's possible with all this stuff in order to do their jobs. Like, you know, you wouldn't hire an architect that doesn't know physics and wood and metal and concrete. Yeah, it's like this is the medium for which you're designing. So if you are a Photoshop designer, UX designer, used to doing static wireframes, it absolutely is your job to become competent. Does that mean you need to be the JavaScript whiz? Absolutely not. But you need to have a fundamental understanding. And more importantly, that notion of the handoff is something that should just go away. It's like you just work together. Just. thank you. Yeah.
All right. Well, that seems like a perfect way to wrap up the panel. Please, thank you, Sophie, Val, Brad.
Thank you.
We are going to take a break. And we're going to need everybody back.